Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Tomorrow, May 11th at 7:30 p.m., Vassar College will host a Zoom performance of And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears, created and performed by Cherokee actor and activist Delana Studi.
Gather round. You're about to hear a story. Not just any story. There are stories that really happened, stories that we tell ourselves to get through the day, and stories that we know to be true, somewhere deep in our bones. This story is all of those, jumbled into one. Think of the stories that were told as children. So many have a curse to overcome, don't they? No fairy tales, where the princess falls under a terrible curse, only to be rescued by the hands of the prince who slays the monster. Bible stories, where Eve was cursed for eating the forbidden fruit. Even my people, the Cherokee, have stories like Spear Finger, a shape-shifting woman cursed by her insatiable hunger. And every great story has truth in it, and the truth demands to be told. And a true story is dangerous, because even if you are the best storyteller, you can't outrun the truth. Truth will find you. And you will know when it has, because there will be signs. This is my story, and how it was written in blood.
In this documentary theater piece, And So We Walked, Studi tells the audience about herself, her history, her family, her father is Cherokee and her mother is white, and about the trip she and her father took to find their family's origins, to see where her people lived before the United States government removed approximately 60,000 Native Americans from their homes between 1830 and 1850. Delana Studi, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us when you first had the idea to explore your ancestry and your people in this way, in this play.
Honestly, it's something I've been dreaming about my entire life, because my family were Cherokee. We were relocated to Oklahoma before Oklahoma was a state during the Trail of Tears. But no one in my family talked about our life before the trail. I didn't know where we had originated. I knew Cherokee Nation before the removal was, at the time, North Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama. And but I didn't know from what state or even what small town I was from. So it was very interesting that was something I always found intriguing and something I always wanted to investigate. In fact, when I was in fourth grade for a history project, I dressed up one of my Barbie dolls in a ribbon dress, and I put her in front of one of our structures. And I was talking about the Trail of Tears and about how my family was moved here through the Trail of Tears. That was one of my projects that I did. And it's been something that's been inside of me for a very long time. I just didn't have the means or the resources to reach out and figure out what was going on until recently. And so through that, I was able to do the research. I was able to go to Cherokee, North Carolina, and speak to the elders and visit the museum and find out exactly where my family came from.
And this story is so much about your family. Your father, who is Cherokee, joins you for the trip and to do the interviews. What was it like exploring something that is so large for your people, but so, so, so personal to you?
Oh, goodness. It was honestly a very life-changing event in my life. My father, it was very essential that he come with me, because my father is an old speaker, which means his first language is Cherokee. And I know a lot of our elders in North Carolina speak only Cherokee. So it was important to me that I had someone that could talk to them. My Cherokee, even though I speak some of it, I'm very limited in my vocabulary. And so it was very important to me that we had, an elder on deck that could also talk to the other elders. And so my father was my touchstone. He was my cultural consultant, my language advisor, and also, he was my moral support. What was interesting is when we started the trail, I was worried the trail was going to be very hard on him because, he's an older gentleman. He went through the American Indian boarding school experience. I'm the first generation of my family not to go. My father's been part of the assimilation system ever since the beginning. And so I was afraid that this would bring up some old trauma for him.
Mm-hmm.
But what was fascinating about it was he was the one that was better able to adapt. You know, I always say along the trail, my father came alive and I was faced with death because it was just, my father has a stronger resiliency than I do. And it's probably because of his boarding school experience, but he was able to find the joy in these places where I was bogged down in all the sadness.
You say in the play at one point when he was speaking his language to one of the oldest living native speakers, I don't remember her name right now, but the old woman there.
Dr. Amanda Swimmer.
Thank you.
Yes.
That he looked decades younger as he was speaking fully in his own language.
Yes, and it made me realize that my father, every time he speaks to me, he code switches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's always having to change who he is to speak English to me. His first language is Cherokee. I've never had a lengthy conversation with him in his own language. And so having him speak to Miss Mandy put it in perspective that my father has always been adapting and evolving, but at the same time, he's never gotten to be his authentic self until that very moment. And it just reminded me of, you know, what was taken from our people and also how our people are so resilient and we're still here today. But at the same time, you know, we have the elders that are keeping the language alive. But it was, you know, for the first time in my life, I saw my daddy for his true authentic self.
One aspect of the piece that I really did love is my dad is ex-military, sort of stoic, sort, you know, very stubborn. And we have a great relationship, but we, you know, really get on each other's nerves. And it's so clear that that's a similar relationship to what you have with your dad. He is this like amazing support person to you, but he's also your dad, you know?
Yes, exactly. And my father was ex-military as well. So he has probably a lot of the same characteristics, but it's, you know, he's one of those people that he's a man of a very few words. And I love him dearly, but at the same time, we know how to push each other's buttons.
You found the origins of your family, where you came from, sort of magically quickly in a room full of binders. Could you relay that story to us and what that meant to you?
Oh, of course. So I was very, it was very magical. My father believes that if something's meant to happen, then things will fall into place. You know, you just have to put in a little bit of the work and then all of a sudden doors will start opening. But you have to make the initiative. So my first trip to Cherokee, North Carolina to do research, the day before I left, I was like, I should call the Cherokee Museum and see if they have any information. And so I happened to call and, you know, through the way the world works, the call was routed to the director of education. And I said, I'm coming in tomorrow. I know it's short notice, but I was wondering if you have any information about the people that lived in the area before the Trail of Tears and how I'd find out the information. And she was like, absolutely. I'll be in tomorrow. I'll help you find that. And I was like, okay. So the next day I flew into North Carolina. I drove up to Cherokee with my producer, director, Corey Madden. And we were in the archives, right? We met the director of education. She took us into the archives and she's showing us these maps. And apparently the U.S. government was doing these appraisals on Cherokee property 20 years before the removal. So they had been planning on removing our people for a very long time. And these appraisals were so in depth. They knew how many women were there that were under the age of 16 and over 16, how many men over 18, under 18, how many trees they had and what kinds. They knew how many structures, how many animals. I mean, it was really in depth. And at the bottom, there was the appraisal of what they thought the property and all the things on the property were worth. And I remember Barbara, the director of education, was showing this, and she said, well, hopefully we can find a map of your family's home here. And I remember just thinking, oh, God, I hope not, because it's just so disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just blindly reached behind me and pulled a binder off of a bookshelf. And these are the retractable bookshelves that you find in most libraries. And they had all these 1-inch binders that were numbered from like 1 to 800, something really ridiculous. And I remember just pulling one out and just flipping to a page. The page I happened to flip to, there was an archaeologist named Brett Riggs who did excavations of 2 homesteads in the western part of North Carolina, because at that time they were debating, did the Trail of Tears actually start in North Carolina?
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to prove that it did start there. I mean, the trail honestly didn't start in one location. It started at people's homes. and people forget that, is physically moving people from their homes.
Of course.
And so he had done two excavations, and I was looking at this detailed list of what they had found in this family's trash midden. And so there was, you know, peacock feathers and shards of china that they realized, oh, they had matching dishes back then. So this was from a family that was in the top 3% of the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such a fascinating just inventory. And there was a beautiful beaded earring. It was the most lovely thing I've ever seen. And when people hear me say beaded earring, they think native beadery, which is also beautiful. But in this way, this one was very Victorian in nature. It was just exquisite. It's something I would be like, oh, that's gorgeous. And I wear it now. But
right.
But it was something you don't really associate with native people, right? Because it looked very affluent and, English.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I was like, oh, my gosh, this is amazing. And I said, who was this? And she said, oh, you should flip to the front of the book and it should tell you the family's name. And so I did. I turned to the first page and I found out it was my great-great-grandmother's family. It was the Christies, which is my grandmother's maiden name. So in that blink of an eye, just some random page I happened to flip to, I was able to find out so much about my family, including the map coordinates to where they lived. And at that time, Corey and I extended our visit to Cherokee. We weren't only going to be there for the afternoon, but we decided to stay for the weekend to do more research. And we were able to drive down to where my family's cabin used to be.
It is amazing that that is part of the story. I mean, it's unbelievable. You couldn't write it. You couldn't write it. It's wild.
You couldn't write it. Yes. I honestly thought I would be there all afternoon combing through books, and I was hoping I'd find a family name and perhaps a little information. I did not know I would find such a treasure trove. And then when we drove down to Murphy, North Carolina, to visit the homestead, there was a little museum, a Cherokee museum at the bottom of a folklore museum. The top floor was, dolls and different kinds of salt and the silverware they had at the time. At the bottom in the basement was a Cherokee museum. And it was in the Cherokee museum that we actually found a replica of my family's cabin. They had built a replica of the cabin in the museum.
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. Yeah.
Every time I talk about it, I'm like, that really happened.
Right, right. No, it's otherworldly.
I'm speaking with Delaina Studi, Cherokee actor, author, and activist. She will perform And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears, tomorrow night at 7:30 in an online event presented by Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, facing the horrors of the Trail of Tears, facing the just absolutely terrible actions taken upon the Cherokee people and other tribes during the Indian removal.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with it? I don't think, I would never say come to terms or something, because there's no justification, but how do you cope with the pain of that history, and how do you think that other members of the tribe do?
It's, honestly, it's an ongoing process. And for me on the trail, there were moments where, one of my favorite things my father made me do is he said he would only go on the trail with me if I did not do research. And I'm one of those people that like to research things ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
I like to know what's going to happen. I like to know what this place was, so I can kind of ready myself and get my armor up. I'm that person that will watch a scary movie and then also look on the internet and find out what the summary is so I know who's going to die next.
Right.
Just so that I'm emotionally prepared. That's just who I am. And so my father said, I don't want you to do research on any of the places we visit until after we visit them. I want you to go in and I just want you to feel what comes up for you and just see if there's anything in your blood memory. And I was like, that's silly, but if that's what it takes to get you to go on the trail with me, then I will honor that and I won't do research until afterwards. And so it was really quite amazing about the places we would visit. And sometimes I would just walk into a place and I would just feel sick to my stomach, like something was not right about this place. And then I'd find out that's where, a Cherokee person committed suicide or a lot of our elders died. And of course I would have the opposite. I'd walk into a place and I'm like, this place is special. I don't know why, but I feel like I'm connected to this place. And then I find out that's where our family went to water for thousands of years. And so it was a very interesting juxtaposition of the two. And I feel like I learned more about self-care at that time. When I wrote the play, I was going through my own personal trauma. And so it's probably not the brightest thing I've ever done. I was going through my own personal trauma. So how do we cope with that? Let's go on a trail about our people's trauma.
Right.
Your father. and pretend like nothing happened. And, of course, all that trauma comes up. And, you know, what I discovered about my people is, you know, we're very strong. We're very resilient. We have a great sense of humor. And I think that's how we've survived so much. And, you know, it's also that sense of community. I was keeping my trauma to myself. And it was only until I started sharing it with others, you know, telling people about it and acknowledging that I was lost, that I was able to cope with it. So it was that tribal community, able to go back to my culture and my family and have them help support me, because that's what family does. And I wasn't doing that at that time. And I was afraid to ask for help. And I was, well, I'm not afraid. I was too proud, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel for myself, the way I, you know, it's still an ongoing struggle. I still have to remind myself, this year has been very trying because, you know, we're living through a pandemic and there's so many people dying. You know, I've lost 3 aunties this past year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's easy when you get in those dark places not to reach out. And so it's essential that whenever you start finding yourself in that downward spiral, that you honestly swallow your pride and ask for help. And so that's what the trail taught me. And it taught me to talk to my father. And it also created this new line of communication with my dad. I feel we're so much closer now than we were before. And what was interesting is at the end of the trail, we weren't speaking. We had this huge fight and we didn't speak for 3 months. And then we started talking again, and now we have the best relationship. It's something I will never really fully come to terms with. It's something I'm still further investigating.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I practice a lot of self-care. When I was doing research after the trail to finish writing the play, I would have to limit how much I would read in a day. And I would have to switch off books. So if I was reading a historically heavy book, about the atrocities of the trail, I would limit myself to 30 minutes, then I put it down, and then I go do something fun and lighthearted. It's just, I mean, it's such a weird dichotomy, but that's how I had to learn to take care of myself. But I do feel that I would not have made it to this day if it wasn't for the strength of my family and my community.
Delana Studi's play, And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears, will be streamed by Vassar College May 11th at 7:30 p.m. To learn more, you can visit vassar.edu/news/events. That URL will be linked on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. There is also a site for the play, andsowewalked.com. Delana, thank you again so much for your time and for sharing this story with people.
Well, Do, thank you so much for having me. This means a lot.
Once again, Vassar College will host a Zoom performance of Delana Studi's And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears, tomorrow, May 11th at 7:30 p.m. The event is sponsored by the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center, the American Studies Program at Vassar College, the Dean of the Faculty Office, the Creative Arts Across Disciplines Initiative, with support from the Helen Forster Novi 1928 Fund. As I mentioned, links to more information will be posted along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.